She stopped, whispered something to the sulking black-clad assistant, and said, "Okay, follow me." Her studio had high ceilings and cement walls painted white. There were lots of lighting umbrellas and black screens and extension cords snaking everywhere. Rebecca fiddled with a film cartridge and pretended to be busy. "Tell me about the car accident," I said. "I don't get this, Beck." She opened a canister, put it down, put the top back on, then opened it again. "We've barely spoken in, what, 8 years? All of a sudden you get all obsessive about an old car accident?" I crossed my arms and waited. "Why, Beck, after all this time? Why do you want to know?"
"Tell me."
She kept her eyes averted. The unruly hair fell over half her face, but she didn't bother pushing it back.
"I miss her," she said. "And I miss you, too."
I didn't reply to that.
"I called," she said.
"I know.
I tried to stay in touch. I wanted to be there."
"I'm sorry," I said. And I was. Rebecca had been Elizabeth's best friend. They'd shared an apartment near Washington Square Park before we got married. I should have returned her calls or invited her over or made some kind of effort. But I didn't. Grief can be inordinately selfish.
"Elizabeth told me that you two were in a minor car crash," I went on.
"It was her fault," she said. She took her eyes off the road. "Is that true?"
"What possible difference does it make now?"
"It makes a difference."
"How?"
"What are you afraid of, Rebecca?" Now it was her time for silence. "Was there an accident or not?" Her shoulders slumped as though something internal had been severed. She took a few deep breaths and kept her face down.
"I don't know."
"What do you mean you don't know?"
"She told me it was a car accident, too."
"But you weren't there?"
"No. You were out of town, Beck. I came home one night and Elizabeth was there. She was bruised up. I asked her what happened. She told me she'd been in a car accident, and if anyone asked, we'd been in my car."
"If anyone asked?" Rebecca finally looked up.
"I think she meant you, Beck."
I tried to take this in. "So what really happened?"
"She wouldn't say."
"Did you take her to a doctor?"
"She wouldn't let me."
Rebecca gave me a strange look.
"I still don't get it. Why are you asking me about this now?"
"Tell no one. I'm just trying to get a little closure." She nodded, but she didn't believe me. Neither one of us was a particularly adept liar.
"Did you take any pictures of her?" I asked.
"Pictures?"
"Of her injuries after the accident."
"God, no. Why would I do that?"
"An awfully good question." I sat there and thought about it. I don't know how long.
"Beck?"
"Yeah?"
"You look like hell."
"You don't," I said.
"I'm in love."
"It becomes you."
"Thanks."
"Is he a good guy?"
"The best."
"Maybe he deserves you, then."
"Maybe."
She leaned forward and kissed my cheek. It felt good, comforting.
"Something happened, didn't it?"
This time I opted for the truth. "I don't know." Chapter 13. Shauna and Hester Krimstein sat in Hester's swanky Midtown law office. Hester finished up her phone call and put the receiver back in the cradle.
"No one's doing much talking," Hester said.
"But they didn't arrest him."
"No, not yet."
"So what's going on?" Shauna asked.
"Near as I can tell, they think Beck killed his wife."
"That's nuts," Shauna said.
He was in the hospital, for crying out loud. That Kilroy Looney Tune is on death row.
Not for her murder, the attorney replied.
What? Kellerton's suspected of killing at least 18 women. He confessed to 14, but they only had enough hard evidence to prosecute and convict him on 12. That was enough. I mean, how many death sentences does one man need?
But everyone knows he killed Elizabeth.
Correction, everyone knew.
I don't get it. How can they possibly think Beck had anything to do with it?
I don't know, Hester said. She threw her feet up on her desk and put her hands behind her head.
At least not yet, but we'll have to be on our guard.
How's that?
For one thing, we have to assume the feds are watching us every step. Phone taps, surveillance, that kind of thing.
So?
What do you mean, so?
He's innocent, Hester. Let them watch.
Hester looked up and shook her head. Don't be naive.
What the hell does that mean?
It means that if they tape him having eggs for breakfast, it can be something. He has to be careful. But there's something else.
What?
The feds are going to go after Beck.
How?
Got me, but trust me, they will. They got a hard-on for your friend, and it's been 8 years. That means they're desperate. Desperate feds are ugly, constitutional rights-stamping feds. Shauna sat back and thought about the strange emails from Elizabeth.
What?
Hester said.
Nothing.
Don't hold back on me, Shauna.
I'm not the client here.
You saying Beck isn't telling me everything?
An idea struck Shauna with something approaching horror. She thought about it some more, ran the idea over some test tracks, let it bounce around for a few moments. It made sense, and yet Shauna hoped, nay, prayed, that she was wrong. She stood and hurried toward the door.
I have to go.
What's going on?
Ask your client.
Special agents Nick Carlson and Tom Stone positioned themselves on the same couch over which Beck had recently waxed nostalgic. Kim Parker, Elizabeth's mother, sat across from them with her hands primly in her lap. Her face was a frozen, waxy mask. Hoyt Parker paced.
"So what's so important that you couldn't say anything over the phone?"
Hoyt asked.
"We want to ask you some questions," Carlson said.
"What about?"
"Your daughter."
That froze them both.
"More specifically, we'd like to ask you about her relationship with her husband, Dr. David Beck."
Hoyt and Kim exchanged a glance.
"Why?"
Hoyt asked.
"It involves a matter currently under investigation."
"What matter? She's been dead for 8 years. Her killer is on death row."
"Please, Detective Parker, we're all on the same side here."
The room was still and dry. Kim Parker's lips thinned and trembled. Hoyt looked at his wife and then nodded at the two men. Carlson kept his gaze on Kim.
"Mrs. Parker, how would you describe the relationship between your daughter and her husband?"
"They were very close, very much in love."
"No problems?"
"No," she said. "None."
"Would you describe Dr. Beck as a violent man?"
She looked startled.
"No, never."
They looked at Hoyt. Hoyt nodded his agreement.
"To your knowledge, did Dr. Beck ever hit your daughter?"
"What?"
Carlson tried a kind smile.
"If you could just answer the question."
"Never," Hoyt said. "No one hit my daughter."
"You're certain?"
His voice was firm.
"Very."
Carlson looked toward Kim.
"Mrs. Parker?"
"He loved her so much."
"I understand that, ma'am. But many wife-beaters profess to loving their wives."
"He never hit her."
Hoyt stopped pacing.
"What's going on here?"
Carlson looked at Stone for a moment.
"I want to show you some photographs, if I may. They're a bit disturbing, but I think they're important."
Stone handed Carlson the manila envelope. Carlson opened it. One by one, he placed the photographs of the bruised Elizabeth on a coffee table. He watched for a reaction. Kim Parker, as expected, let out a small cry. Hoyt Parker's face seemed at odds with itself, settling into a distant blankness.
"Where did you get these?"
Hoyt asked softly.
"Have you seen them before?"
"Never," he said. He looked at his wife. She shook her head.
"But I remember the bruises," Kim Parker offered.
"When?"
"I can't remember exactly. Not long before she died. But when I saw them, they were less..."
She searched for the word.
"Pronounced."
"Did your daughter tell you how she got them?"
"She said she was in a car accident."
"Mrs. Parker, we've checked with your wife's insurance company. She never reported a car accident. We checked police files. No one ever made a claim against her. No policeman ever filled out a report."
"So what are you saying?"
Hoyt came in.
"Simply this. If your daughter wasn't in a car accident, how did she get these bruises?"
"You think her husband gave them to her?"
"It's a theory we're working on."
"Based on what?"
The two men hesitated. The hesitation said one of two things. Not in front of the lady, or not in front of the civilian. Hoyt picked up on it.
"Kim, do you mind if I talk to the agents alone for a moment?"
"Not at all."
She stood on wobbly legs and teetered toward the stairs.
"I'll be in the bedroom."
When she was out of sight, Hoyt said,
"Okay, I'm listening."
"We don't think Dr. Beck just beat your daughter," Carlson said. "We think he murdered her."
Hoyt looked from Carlson to Stone and back to Carlson, as though waiting for the punchline. When none came, he moved to the chair.
"You better start explaining."
Chapter 14.
What else had Elizabeth been keeping from me?
As I headed down 10th Avenue toward the Quicken Park, I again tried to dismiss those photographs as merely a record of her car accident injuries. I remembered how nonchalant Elizabeth had been about the whole thing at the time. "Just a fender bender," she said. "No big deal." When I asked for details, she had pretty much brushed me off. Now I knew that she'd lied to me about it. I could tell you that Elizabeth never lied to me, but that would be, in light of this recent discovery, a pretty unconvincing argument. This was, however, the first lie I was aware of. I guess we both had our secrets. When I reached the Quicken Park, I spotted something strange. Or perhaps I should say, someone strange. There on the corner was a man in a tan overcoat. He was looking at me. And he was oddly familiar. No one I knew, but there was still the unease of deja vu. I'd seen this man before, this morning even. Where? I ran through my morning and spotted him in my mind's eye. When I pulled over for coffee at 8 a.m., the man with the tan overcoat had been there, in the parking lot of Starbucks. Was I sure? No, of course not. I diverted my eyes and hurried over to the attendant's booth. The parking attendant, his name tag read Carlo, was watching television and eating a sandwich. He kept his eyes on the screen for half a minute before sliding his gaze toward me. Then he slowly brushed the crumbs off his hands, took my ticket, and stamped it. I quickly paid the man, and he handed me my key. The man in the tan overcoat was still there. I tried very hard not to look in his direction as I walked to my car. I got in, started it up, and when I hit 10th Avenue, I checked the rearview mirror. The man with the tan overcoat didn't so much as glance at me. I kept watching him until I turned toward the West Side Highway. He never looked in my direction. Paranoid. I was going nutsy, paranoid.
So why had Elizabeth lied to me? I thought about it and came up with nothing.
There were still 3 hours until my Bat Street message came in. 3 hours. Man, I needed to distract myself. Thinking too hard about what might be on the other end of the cyber connection shredded my stomach lining. I knew what I had to do. I was just trying to delay the inevitable. When I got home, Grandpa was in his customary chair alone. The television was off. The nurse was yakking on the phone in Russian. She wasn't going to work out. I'd have to call the agency and get her replaced. Small particles of egg were stuck to the corners of Grandpa's mouth, so I took out a handkerchief and gently scraped them away. Our eyes met, but his gaze was locked on something far beyond me. I saw us all up at the lake. Grandpa would be doing his beloved weight loss before and after pose. He'd turn profile, slump, let his elastic gut hang out and shout, "Before!" and then suck it up and flex and yell, "After!" He did it brilliantly. My father would howl. Dad had the greatest, most infectious laugh. It was a total body release. I used to have it, too. It died with him. I could never laugh like that again. Somehow it seemed obscene. Hearing me, the nurse hurried off the phone and hightailed it into the room with a bright smile. I didn't return it. I eyed the basement door. I was still delaying the inevitable. No more stalling. "Stay with him," I said. The nurse bowed her head and sat down. The basement had been finished in the days before people finished basements, and it showed. The once brown shag carpet was pockmarked and water buckled. Faux white brick made from some sort of bizarre synthetic had been glued to asphalt walls. Some sheets had fallen to the shag. Others stopped mid-topple like columns of the Acropolis. In the center of the room, the ping-pong table's green had been washed to an almost in-vogue spearmint. The torn net looked like the barricades after the French troops stormed. The paddles were stripped down to the splintery wood. Some cardboard boxes, many sprouting mold, sat on top of the ping-pong table. Others were piled in the corner. Old clothes were in wardrobe boxes. Not Elizabeth's. Shauna and Linda had cleared those out for me. Goodwill got them, I think. But some of the other boxes held old items. Her items. I couldn't throw them away. And I couldn't let other people have them. I'm not sure why. Some things we pack away, stick in the back of the closet, never expect to see again. But we can't quite make ourselves discard them. Like dreams, I guess. I wasn't sure where I'd put it, but I knew it was there. I started going through old photographs, once again averting my gaze. I was pretty good at that. Though as time went on, the photographs hurt less and less. When I saw Elizabeth and me together in some greening Polaroid, it was as though I were looking at strangers. I hated doing this. I dug deeper into the box. My fingertips hit something made of felt, and I pulled out her tennis varsity letter from high school. With a sad smirk, I remembered her tan legs and the way her braid bounced as she hopped toward the net. On the court, her face was locked in pure concentration. That was how Elizabeth would beat you. She had decent enough ground strokes and a pretty good serve, but what lifted her above her classmates was that focus. I put the letter down gingerly and started digging again. I found what I was looking for at the bottom, her daily planner. The police had wanted it after the abduction, or so I was told. Rebecca came by the apartment and helped them find it. I assumed they searched for clues in it, the same thing I was about to do. But when the body popped up with the K branding, they probably stopped. I thought about that some more, about how everything had been neatly pinned on Kilroy. And another thought scurried through my brain. I ran upstairs to my computer and got online. I found the website for the New York City Department of Correction. Tons of stuff in it, including the name and phone number I needed. I signed off and called Briggs Penitentiary. That's the prison that holds Kilroy. When the recording came on, I pressed in the proper extension and was put through. 3 rings later, a man said,
"Deputy Superintendent Brown speaking."
I told him that I wanted to visit Elroy Kellerton.
And you are?
He said. Dr. David Beck. My wife, Elizabeth Beck, was one of his victims.
I see. Brown hesitated. May I ask the purpose of your visit?
No. There was more silence on the line. I have the right to visit him if he's willing to see me, I said.
Yes, of course, but this is a highly unusual request.
I'm still making it.
The normal procedure is to have your attorney go through his...
But I don't have to, I interrupted. I learned this at a victim's rights website, that I could make the request myself. If Kellerton was willing to see me, I was in. I just want to talk to Kellerton. You have visiting hours tomorrow, don't you?
Yes, we do.
Then if Kellerton agrees, I'll be up tomorrow. Is there a problem with that?
No, sir. If he agrees, there's no problem.
I thanked him and hung up the phone. I was taking action. It felt damn good. The day planner sat on the desk next to me. I was avoiding it again, because as painful as a photograph or recording might be, handwriting was somehow worse, somehow more personal. Elizabeth's soaring capital letters, the firmly crossed T's, the too many loops between letters, the way it all tilted to the right. I spent an hour going through it. Elizabeth was detailed. She didn't shorthand much. What surprised me was how well I'd known my wife. Everything was clear, and there were no surprises. In fact, there was only one appointment I couldn't account for. 3 weeks before her death, there was an entry that read simply, P.F. and a phone number without an area code. In light of how specific she'd been elsewhere, I found this entry a little unsettling. I didn't have a clue what the area code would be. The call was made 8 years ago. Area codes had split and changed several different ways since then. I tried 201 and got a disconnect. I tried 973. An old lady answered. I told her she'd won a free subscription to the New York Post. She gave me her name. Neither initial matched. I tried 212, which was the city, and that was where I hit bingo.
Peter Flannery, attorney at law,
a woman said mid-yawn. May I speak to Mr. Flannery, please?
He's in court.
She could have sounded more bored, but not without a quality prescription. I heard a lot of noise in the background. I'd like to make an appointment to see Mr. Flannery.
You answering the billboard ad?
Billboard ad?
You injured?
Yes, I said. But I didn't see an ad. A friend recommended him. It's a medical malpractice case. I came in with a broken arm and now I can't move it. I lost my job. The pain is nonstop. She set me up for an appointment tomorrow afternoon. I put the phone back into the cradle and frowned. What would Elizabeth be doing with a probable ambulance chaser like Flannery? The sound of the phone made me jump. I snatched it up mid-ring. Hello? I said. It was Shauna.
Where are you? She asked.
Home.
You need to get over here right away, she said.
Chapter 15. Agent Carlson looked Hoyt Parker straight in the eye. As you know, we recently found two bodies in the vicinity of Lake Charmaine. Hoyt nodded. A cell phone chirped. Stone managed to hoist himself up and said, "Excuse me," before lumbering into the kitchen. Hoyt turned back to Carlson and waited. "We know the official account of your daughter's death," Carlson said. "She and her husband, David Beck, visited the lake for an annual ritual. They went swimming in the dark. Kilroy lay in wait. He assaulted Dr. Beck and kidnapped your daughter. End of story."
"And you don't think that's what happened?"
"No, Hoyt." "Can I call you Hoyt?" Hoyt nodded. "No, Hoyt, we don't."
"So how do you see it?"
"I think David Beck murdered your daughter and pinned it on a serial killer." Hoyt,
A 28-year veteran of the NYPD knew how to keep a straight face, but he still leaned back as though the words were jabs at his chin.
Let's hear it. Okay, let's start from the beginning. Beck takes your daughter up to a secluded lake, right?
Right.
You been there?
Many times.
Huh?
We were all friends. Kim and I were close to David's parents. We used to visit all the time.
Then you know how secluded it is.
Yes.
Dirt road, a sign that you'd only see if you knew to look for it. It's as hidden can be, no signs of life.
What's your point?
What are the odds of Kilroy pulling up that road?
Hoyt raised his palms to the sky.
What are the odds of anyone meeting up with a serial killer?
True, okay. But in other cases, there was a logic to it. Kellerton abducted somebody off a city street. He carjacked a victim, even broke into a house. But think about it. He sees this dirt road and somehow decides to search for a victim up there? I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's highly unlikely.
Hoyt said, "Go on."
You'll admit that there are plenty of logic holes in the accepted scenario.
All cases have logic holes.
Right. Okay, but let me try an alternate theory on you. Let's just say that Dr. Beck wanted to kill your daughter.
Why?
For one thing, a $200,000 life insurance policy.
He doesn't need money.
Everybody needs it, Hoyt, you know that.
I don't buy it.
Look, we're still digging here. We don't know all the motivations yet. But let me just get through our scenario, okay?
Hoyt gave him a suit-yourself shrug.
We have evidence here that Dr. Beck beat her.
What evidence? She has some photographs. She told my wife she'd been in a car accident.
Come on, Hoyt. Carlson swept his hand to the photographs. Look at the expression on your daughter's face. That looked like the face of a woman in a car accident?
No, Hoyt thought, it didn't.
Where'd you find these pictures?
I'll get to that in a second, but let's go back to my scenario, okay? Let's assume for the moment that Dr. Beck beat your daughter and that he had a hell of an inheritance coming his way.
A lot of assuming.
True, but stay with me. Think of the accepted scenario and all those holes. Now compare it with this one. Dr. Beck brings your daughter up to a secluded spot where he knows there will be no witnesses. He hires two thugs to grab her. He knows about Kilroy. It's in all the papers. Plus, your brother worked on the case. Did he ever discuss it with you or Beck?
Hoyt sat still for a moment.
Go on.
The two hired thugs abduct and kill your daughter. Naturally, the first suspect will be the husband. Always is in a case like this, right? But the two thugs brand her cheek with a letter K. Next thing we know, it's all blamed on Kilroy.
But Beck was assaulted. His head injury was real.
Sure, but we both know that's not inconsistent with him being behind it. How would Beck explain coming out of the abduction healthy? Hi, guess what? Someone kidnapped my wife, but I'm fine. It'd never play. Getting whacked on the head gave his story credibility.
He took a hell of a shot.
He was dealing with thugs, Hoyt. They probably miscalculated. And what about his injury, anyway? He tells some bizarre story about miraculously crawling out of the water and dialing 911. I gave several doctors Beck's old medical chart. They claim his account of what he did defies medical logic. It would have been pretty much impossible given his injuries.
Hoyt considered that. He had often wondered about that himself. How had Beck survived and called for help?
What else? Hoyt said.
There's strong evidence that suggests the two thugs, not Kilroy, assaulted Beck.
What evidence?
Buried with the bodies, we found a baseball bat with blood on it. The full DNA match will take a while, but the preliminary results strongly suggest that the blood is Beck's.
Agent Stone plodded back in the room and sat down hard. Hoyt once again said,
"Go on."
The rest is pretty obvious. The two thugs do the job. They kill your daughter and pin it on Kilroy. Then they come back to get the rest of their payment, Or maybe they decide to extort some more money from Dr. Beck, I don't know. Whatever. Beck has to get rid of him. He sets up a meeting in the secluded woods near Lake Charmaine. The two thugs probably thought they were dealing with a wimpy doctor, or maybe he caught them unprepared. Either way, Beck shoots them and buries the bodies, along with a baseball bat and whatever evidence might haunt him later on. The perfect crime now. Nothing to tie him with the murder. Let's face it, if we didn't get enormously lucky, the bodies would have never been found. Hoyt shook his head.
Hell of a theory. There's more. Like?
Carlson looked at Stone. Stone pointed to his cell phone.
I just got a strange phone call from someone at Briggs Penitentiary, Stone said. It seems your son-in-law called there today and demanded a meeting with Kilroy.
Hoyt now looked openly stunned.
Why the hell would he do that? You tell us, Stone responded. But keep in mind that Beck knows we're on to him. All of a sudden he has this overwhelming desire to visit the man he set up as your daughter's killer.
Hell of a coincidence, Carlson added.
You think he's trying to cover his tracks?
You have a better explanation? Hoyt sat back and tried to let all of this settle.
He left something out.
What? He pointed to the photographs on the table.
Who gave you those?
In a way, Carlson said, I think your daughter did. Hoyt's face looked drained.
More specifically, her alias did, one Sarah Goodhart. Your daughter's middle name and the name of this street. I don't understand.
At the crime scene, Carlson said, one of the two thugs, Melvin Bartola, had a small key in his shoe. Carlson held up the key. Hoyt took it from his hand, peering at it as though it held some mystical answer. See the UCB on the flip side? Hoyt nodded. That stands for United Central Bank. We finally traced this key down to their branch at 1772 Broadway in the city. The key opens box 174, which is registered to one Sarah Goodhart. We got a search warrant for it. Hoyt looked up.
The photographs were in there?
Carlson and Stone glanced at each other. They had already made the decision not to tell Hoyt everything they knew about that box. Not until all the tests came back and they knew for sure. But both men nodded now.
Think about it, Hoyt. Your daughter kept these pictures hidden in a safety deposit box. The reasons are obvious.
One more? We questioned Dr. Beck. He admitted knowing nothing about the pictures. He'd never seen them before.
Why would your daughter hide them from him? You talked to Beck?
Yes.
What else did he say?
Not much, because he demanded a lawyer. Carlson waited a beat, then he leaned forward. He not only lawyered up, he called Hester Krimstein. That sound like the act of an innocent man to you? Hoyt actually gripped the sides of the chair, trying to steady himself.
You can't prove any of this.
Not yet, no. But we know. That's half the battle sometimes.
So what are you going to do?
Only one thing we can do. Carlson smiled at him. Apply pressure until something breaks.
This ends Disc 3. Tell no one. Disc 4.
Larry Gandil looked over the day's developments and mumbled to himself,
not good.
One, the FBI picks up Beck and questions him. Two, Beck calls a photographer named Rebecca Shays. He asks her about an old car accident involving his wife. Then he visits her studio. A photographer, no less. Three, Beck calls Briggs Penitentiary and says he wants to meet Elroy Kellerton. Fourth, Beck calls Peter Flannery's office. All of this was puzzling. None of it was good. Eric Wu hung up the phone and said, You are not going to like this.
What?
Our source with the FBI says that they suspect Beck killed his wife. Gandil nearly fell over.
Explain.
That's all the source knows. Somehow they've tied the two dead bodies by the lake to Beck.
Very puzzling.
Let me see those emails again,
Gandil said. Eric Wu handed them to him. When Gandil thought about who could have sent them, the creeping feeling in the pit of his stomach started to claw and grow. He tried to add the pieces together. He'd always wondered how Beck had survived that night. Now he wondered something else. Had anyone else survived it?
What time is it?
Gandil asked.
6:30.
Beck still hasn't looked up that Bat whatever address?
Bat Street. And no, he hasn't.
Anything more on Rebecca Shays?
Just what we already know. Close friend of Elizabeth Parker's. They shared an apartment before Peck married Beck. I checked old phone records. Beck hasn't called her in years.
So why would he contact her now?
Wu shrugged.
Ms. Shays must know something.
Griffin's scope had been very clear. Learn what you can, then bury it. And use Wu.
We need to have a chat with her,
Gandil said. Chapter 16. Shauna met me on the ground floor of a high-rise at 462 Park Avenue in Manhattan.
Come on, she said without preamble. I have something to show you upstairs.
I checked my watch. A little under 2 hours until the Bat Street message came in. We entered an elevator. Shauna hit the button for the 23rd floor. The lights climbed and the blind person counter beeped.
Hester got me thinking,
Shauna said. About what?
She said the feds would be desperate. That they'd do anything to get you?
So? The elevator sounded its final ding.
Hang on, you'll see.
The door slid open on a massive cubicle-divided floor, the norm in the city nowadays. Rip off the ceiling and view from above, and you'd have a very hard time telling the difference between this floor and a rat maze. From down here, too, when you thought about it. Shauna marched between countless cloth-lined dividers. I trailed in her wake. Halfway down, she turned left and then right and then left again.
Maybe I should drop breadcrumbs, I said.
Her voice was flat.
Good one.
Thank you, I'm here all week. She wasn't laughing. What is this place anyway, I asked.
A company called Digicom. The agency works with them sometimes.
Doing what?
You'll see.
We made a final turn into a cluttered cubbyhole occupied by a young man with a long head and the slender fingers of a concert pianist.
This is Farrell Lynch. Farrell, this is David Beck.
I shook the slender hand briefly. Farrell said, Hi. I nodded.
Okay, Shauna said. Key it up.
Farrell Lynch swiveled his chair so that he was facing the computer. Shauna and I watched over his shoulders. He started typing with those slender fingers.
Keyed up, he said. Run it.
He hit the return button. The screen went black, and then Humphrey Bogart appeared. He wore a fedora and a trench coat. I recognized the scene right away. The fog, the plane in the background, the finale of Casablanca. I looked at Shauna.
Wait, she said.
The camera was on Bogey. He was telling Ingrid Bergman that she was getting on that plane with Laszlo and that the problems of three little people didn't amount to a hill of beans in this world. And then, when the camera went back to Ingrid Bergman...
It wasn't Ingrid Bergman.
I blinked. There beneath the famed hat, gazing up at Bogey and bathed in the gray glow, was Shauna.
I can't go with you, Rick.
The computer, Shauna said dramatically.
Because I'm madly in love with Ava Gardner.
I turned to Shauna. My eyes asked the question. She nodded yes. I said it anyway.
You think...
I stammered.
You think I was fooled by trick photography?
Farrell took that one.
Digital photography, he corrected me. Far simpler to manipulate.
He spun his chair toward me.
See, computer images aren't film. They're really just pixels in files. Not unlike your word processing document. You know how easy it is to change a word processing document, right? To alter content or fonts or spacing?
I nodded.
Well, for someone with even a rudimentary understanding of digital imaging, that's how easy it is to manipulate a computer's streaming images. These aren't pictures, nor are they films or tapes. Computer video streams are simply a bunch of pixels. Anyone can manipulate them. Simply cut and paste, and then you run a blend program.
I looked at Shauna. But she looked older in the video, I insisted. Different. Shauna said,
Farrell?
He hit another button. Bogey returned. When they went to Ingrid Bergman this time, Shauna looked 70 years old.
Age progression software, Farrell explained. It's mostly used to age missing children, but nowadays they sell a home version at any software store. I can also change any part of Shauna's image, her hairstyle, her eye color, the size of her nose. I can make her lips thinner or thicker, give her a tattoo, whatever.
Thank you, Farrell, Shauna said. She gave him a look of dismissal a blind man could read.
Excuse me,
Farrell said before making himself scarce. I couldn't think. When Farrell was out of earshot, Shauna said,
I remembered a photo shoot I did last month. One picture came out perfectly. The sponsor loved it, except my earring had slipped down. We brought the image over here. Farrell did a quick cut and paste, and voila, my earring was back in the right place.
I shook my head.
Think about it, Beck. The feds think you killed Elizabeth, but they have no way to prove it. Hester explained how desperate they'd become. I started thinking, maybe they'd play mind games with you. What better mind game than sending you these emails?
But kiss time.
What about it?
How would they know about kiss time?
I know about it. Linda knows about it. I bet Rebecca knows, too. Maybe Elizabeth's parents. They could have found out.
I felt tears rush up to the surface. I tried to work my voice and managed to croak out,
It's a hoax?
I don't know, Beck. I really don't.
But let's be rational here. If Elizabeth was alive, where has she been for 8 years? Why choose now of all times to come back from the grave? The same time by coincidence that the FBI starts suspecting you of killing her. And come on. Do you really believe she's still alive? I know you want to. Hell, I want to. But let's try to look at this rationally. When you really think about it, which scenario makes more sense?
I stumbled back and fell into a chair. My heart started crumbling. I felt the hope start to shrivel up.
A hoax. Has this all been nothing but a hoax?
Chapter 17. Once he was settled inside Rebecca Shea's studio, Larry Gandel called his wife on the cell phone.
I'll be home late, he said.
Don't forget to take your pill, Patty told him.
Gandel had a mild case of diabetes, controlled through diet and a pill, no insulin.
I will.
Eric Wu, still plugged into his Walkman, carefully laid down a vinyl drop cloth near the door.
Gandil hung up the phone and snapped on a pair of latex gloves. The search was both thorough and time-consuming. Like most photographers, Rebecca Shays saved tons of negatives. There were four metal file cabinets jammed full of them. They checked Rebecca Shays' schedule. She was finishing up a shoot. She'd be back here to work the dark room in about an hour. Not enough time.
"You know what would help?" Wu said.
"What?"
"Having some idea what the hell we're looking for."
"Beck, get these cryptic emails," Gandil said. "And what does he do? For the first time in 8 years, he rushes over to see his wife's oldest friend. We need to know why."
Wu looked through him some more. "Why don't we just wait and ask her?"
"We will, Eric."
Wu nodded slowly and turned away. Gandil spotted a long metal desk in the dark room. He tested it. Strong. The size was about right, too. You could lay someone on it and tape a limb to each table leg.
"How much duct tape did we bring?"
"Enough," Wu said.
"Do me a favor, then," Gandil said. "Move the drop cloth under the table."
Half an hour until I picked up the Bat Street message. Shauna's demonstration had hit me like a surprise left hook. I felt groggy, and I took the full count. But a funny thing happened. I got my ass off the canvas. I stood back up and shook off the cobwebs and started circling. We were in my car. Shauna had insisted on coming back to the house with me. A limousine would take her back in a few hours. I know that she wanted to comfort me, but it was equally clear that she didn't want to go home yet. "Something I don't get," I said. Shauna turned to me. "The feds think I killed Elizabeth, right?"
"Right."
"So why would they send me emails pretending she's alive?" Shauna had no quick answer. "Think about it," I said. "You claim that this is some sort of elaborate plot to get me to reveal my guilt. But if I killed Elizabeth, I'd know that it was a trick."
"It's a mind game," Shauna said.
"But that doesn't make sense. If you want to play a mind game with me, send me emails and pretend to be, I don't know, someone who witnessed the murder or something." Shauna thought about it.
"I think they're just trying to keep you off balance, Beck."
"Yeah, but still, it doesn't add up."
"Okay, how long until the next message comes in?"
I checked the clock. 20 minutes. Shauna sat back in her seat.
"We await and see what it says."
Eric Wu set up his laptop on the floor in a corner of Rebecca Shays' studio. He checked Beck's office computer first, still idle. The clock read a little past 8 o'clock. The clinic was long closed. He switched over to the home computer. For a few seconds, there was nothing. And then... "Beck just signed on," Wu said. Larry Gandil hurried over.
"Can we get on and see the message before him?"
"It wouldn't be a good idea."
"Why not?"
"If we sign in and then he tries to, it will tell him that someone is currently using that screen name."
"He'll know he's being watched?"
"Yes, but it doesn't matter. We're watching him in real time. The moment he reads the message, we'll see it too."
"Okay, let me know when."
Wu squinted at the screen.
"He just brought up the Bigfoot site. It should be any second now."
I typed in Bigfoot.com and hit the return button. My right leg started jackhammering. It does that when I'm nervous. Shauna put her hand on my knee. My knee slowed to a stop. She took the hand off. My knee stayed still for a minute and then it started up again. Shauna put her hand back on my knee. The cycle began again. Shauna was playing it cool, but I know that she kept sneaking glances at me. She was my best friend. She'd support me to the end. But only an idiot wouldn't be wondering at this juncture if my elevator was stopping at every floor. They say that insanity, like heart disease or intelligence, is hereditary. The thought had been running through my mind since I'd first seen Elizabeth on the street cam. It wasn't a comforting one. My father died in a car crash when I was 20. His car toppled over an embankment. According to an eyewitness, a truck driver from Wyoming, my father's Buick drove straight off it. It had been a cold night. The road, while well plowed, was slick. Many suggested, well, suggested in whispers anyway, that he committed suicide. I don't believe it. Yes, he had been more withdrawn and quiet in his last few months, and yes, I often wonder if all that made him more susceptible to an accident. But suicide? No way. My mother, always a fragile person of seemingly gentle neuroses, reacted by slowly losing her mind. She literally shrank into herself. Linda tried to nurse her for 3 years until even she agreed that Mom needed to be committed. Linda visits her all the time. I don't. After a few more moments, the Bigfoot homepage came up. I found the user name box and typed in Bat Street. I hit the tab key, and in the password text box, I typed teenage. I hit return. Nothing happened.
"You forgot to click the sign-in icon," Shauna said.
I looked at her. She shrugged. I clicked the icon. The screen went white. Then an ad for a CD store came up. The bar on the bottom went back and forth in a slow wave. The percentage climbed slowly. When it hit about 18%, it vanished, and then several seconds later, a message appeared. Error. Either the username or password you entered is not in our database.
Try again, Shauna said.
I did. The same error message came up. The computer was telling me the account didn't even exist.
What did that mean?
I had no idea. I tried to think of a reason that the account wouldn't exist. I checked the time, 8:13:34 p.m.
Kiss time.
Could that be the answer? Could it be that the account, like the link yesterday, simply didn't exist yet? I mulled that one over. It was possible, of course, but unlikely. As though reading my mind, Shauna said,
"Maybe we should wait until 8:15.
So I tried again at 8:15, at 8:18, at 8:20. Nothing but the same error message.
The feds must have pulled the plug, Shauna said.
I shook my head, not willing yet to give up. My legs started shaking again. Shauna used one hand to stop it and one hand to answer her cell phone. She started barking at someone on the other end. I checked the clock. I tried again. Nothing. Twice more. Nothing. It was after 8:30 now.
She could be late, Shauna said.
I frowned.
When you saw her yesterday, Shauna tried, you didn't know where she was, right?
Right.
So maybe she's in a different time zone, Shauna said. Maybe that's why she's late.
A different time zone? I frowned some more. Shauna shrugged. We waited another hour. Shauna, to her credit, never said I told you so. After a while, she put a hand on my back and said,
Hey, I got an idea.
I turned to her.
I'm going to wait in the other room, Shauna said. I think that might help.
How do you figure?
See, if this were a movie, this would be the part where I get all fed up by your craziness and storm out, and then bingo, the message appears. You know, so only you see it, and everyone still thinks you're crazy. Like on Scooby-Doo, when he and Shaggy see the ghost and no one believes him.
I thought about it.
Worth a try, I said.
Good. So why don't I go wait in the kitchen for a while? Take your time. When the message comes in, just give a little shout.
She stood. You're just humoring me, aren't you? I said. Shauna thought about it.
Yeah, probably.
She left then. I turned and faced the screen. And I waited.
Chapter 18. Nothing's happening, Eric Wu said. Beck keeps trying to sign on, but all he gets is an error message. Larry Gandil was about to ask a follow-up question when he heard the elevator rev up. He checked the clock. Rebecca Shays was right on time. Eric Wu turned away from his computer. He looked at Larry Gandil with the kind of eyes that make a man take a step back. Gandil took out his gun, a 9mm this time, just in case. Wu frowned. He moved his bulk to the door and flipped off the light. They waited in the dark. 20 seconds later, the elevator stopped on their floor. Rebecca Shays rarely thought about Elizabeth and Beck anymore. It had, after all, been 8 years. But this morning, events had stirred up some long-dormant sensations, nagging sensations, about the car accident. After all these years, Beck had finally asked her about it. 8 years ago, Rebecca had been prepared to tell him all about it, but Beck hadn't returned her calls. As time went by, and after an arrest had been made, she saw no point in dredging up the past. It would only hurt Beck. And after Kilroy's arrest, it seemed irrelevant. But the nagging sensation, the sensation that Elizabeth's bruises from the car accident were somehow a precursor to her murder, lingered, even though it made no sense. More than that, the nagging sensation taunted her, making her wonder if she, Rebecca, had insisted, really insisted, on finding out the truth about the car accident. Maybe, just maybe, she could have saved her friend. The lingering, however, faded away over time. At the end of the day, Elizabeth had been her friend, and no matter how close you are, you get over a friend's death. Gary Lamont had come into her life 3 years ago and changed everything. Yes, Rebecca Shays, the bohemian photographer from Greenwich Village, had fallen in love with a money-grubbing Wall Street bond trader. They'd gotten married and moved into a trendy high-rise on the Upper West Side. Funny how life worked. Rebecca stepped into the freight elevator and slid the gate down. The lights were out, which was hardly unusual in this building. The elevator started heading up to her floor, the churning sound reverberating off the stone. Sometimes at night she could hear the horses whinny, but they were silent now. The smell of hay and something probably fouler mingled in the air. She liked being here at night. The way the solitude blended with the city's night noises made her feel her most artsy. Her mind started drifting back to the conversation she'd had last night with Gary. He wanted to move out of New York City, preferably to a spacious home on Long Island at Sands Point, where he'd been raised. The idea of moving to the burbs horrified her. More than her love of the city, she knew that it would be the final betrayal of her bohemian roots. She'd become what she swore she would never become, her mother and her mother's mother. The elevator stopped. She lifted the gate and stepped down the corridor. All the lights were off up here. She pulled back her hair and tied it into a thick ponytail. She peered at her watch. Almost 9 o'clock. The building would be empty, of human beings at least. Her shoes clacked against the cool cement. The truth was, and Rebecca was having a hard time accepting it, she being a bohemian and all, that the more she thought about it, the more she realized that, yes, she wanted children, and that the city was a lousy place to raise them. Children need a backyard and swings and fresh air, and Rebecca Shays was just reaching a decision that would have no doubt thrilled her broker husband, Gary, when she stuck her key in the door and opened her studio.
She went inside and flipped the light switch. That was when she saw the weirdly shaped Asian man. For a moment or two, the man simply stared at her. Rebecca stood frozen in his gaze. Then the Asian man stepped to the side, almost behind her, and blasted a fist into the small of her back. It was like a sledgehammer hit her kidney. Rebecca crumbled to her knees. The man grabbed her neck with two fingers. He squeezed a pressure point. Rebecca saw bright lights. With his free hand, the man dug with fingers like ice picks under her ribcage. When they reached her liver, her eyes bulged. The pain was beyond anything she'd ever imagined. She tried to scream, but only a choking grunt escaped her mouth. From across the room, a man's voice sliced through the haze.
"Where is Elizabeth?"
the voice asked. For the first time. But not the last. Chapter 19. I stayed in front of that damn computer and started drinking pretty heavily. I tried logging onto the site a dozen different ways. I used Explorer and then I used Netscape. I cleared my cache and reloaded the pages and signed off my provider and signed back on again. It didn't matter. I still got the error message. At 10 o'clock, Shauna headed back into the den. Her cheeks were glowing with drink. Mine, too, I imagined.
No luck?
Go home, I said. She nodded.
Yeah, I think I'd better.
The limousine was there in 5 minutes. Shauna wobbled to the curb, fairly wasted on bourbon and rolling rock. Me too. Shauna opened the door and turned back to me.
Were you ever tempted to cheat? I mean, when you two were married?
No, I said. Shauna shook her head, disappointed.
You know nothing about how to mess up your life.
I kissed her goodbye and went back inside. I continued to gaze at the screen as though it were something holy. Nothing changed. Chloe slowly approached a few minutes later. She nudged my hand with her wet nose. Through her forest of hair, our eyes met, and I swear that Chloe understood what I was feeling. I'm not one of those who give human characteristics to dogs. For one thing, I think it might demean them. But I do believe they have a base understanding of what their anthropological counterparts are feeling. They say that dogs can smell fear. Is it such a stretch to believe that they also smell joy or anger or sadness? I smiled down at Chloe and petted her head. She put a paw on my arm in a comforting gesture. "You want to go for a walk, girl?" I said. Chloe's reply was to bound about like a circus freak on speed. Like I told you before, it's the little things. The night air tingled in my lungs. I tried to concentrate on Chloe, her frolicking step, her wagging tail, but I was, well, crestfallen. Crestfallen. That's not a word I use very often, but I thought it fit. I hadn't fully bought Shauna's too-neat digital trick hypothesis. Yeah, someone could manipulate a photograph and make it part of a video, and yes, someone could have known about kiss time, and yes, someone could have even made the lips whisper, "I'm sorry," and yes, my hunger probably helped me make the illusion real and made me susceptible to such trickery. And the biggest, yes, Shauna's hypothesis made a hell of a lot more sense than a return from the grave. But there were two things that overrode a lot of that. First off, I'm not one for flights of fancy. I'm frighteningly boring and more grounded than most. Second, the hunger could have clouded my reasoning, and digital photography could do a lot of things. But not those eyes. Her eyes. Elizabeth's eyes. There was no way, I thought, that they could be old photographs manipulated into a digital video. Those eyes belonged to my wife. Was my rational mind sure of it? No, of course not. I'm not a fool. But between what I saw and all the questions I'd raised, I had semi-dismissed Shauna's video demonstration. I had come home still believing that I was to receive a message from Elizabeth. Now I didn't know what to think.
The booze was probably helping in that respect. Chloe stopped to do some prolonged sniffing. I waited under a streetlight and stared at my elongated shadow. Kiss time. Chloe barked at a movement in the bush. A squirrel sprinted across the street. Chloe growled and feigned a chase. The squirrel stopped and turned back toward us. Chloe barked a, "Boy, you're lucky I'm on a leash" sound. She didn't mean it. Chloe was a pure thoroughbred wimp. Kiss time. I tilted my head the way Chloe does when she hears a strange sound. I thought again about what I had seen yesterday on my computer, and I thought about the pain someone had gone through to keep this whole thing secret. The unsigned email telling me to click the hyperlink at kiss time. The second email setting up a new account in my name. They're watching. Someone was working hard to keep these communications under wraps. Kiss time. If someone, okay, if Elizabeth, had simply wanted to give me a message, why hadn't she just called or written it in an email? Why make me jump through all these hoops? The answer was obvious. Secrecy. Someone, I won't say Elizabeth again, wanted to keep it all a secret. And if you have a secret, it naturally follows that you have someone you want to keep it secret from. And maybe that someone is watching or searching or trying to find you. Either that or you're paranoid. Normally I'd side with paranoid, but they're watching. What did that mean exactly? Who was watching? The feds? And if the feds were behind the emails in the first place, why would they warn me that way? The feds wanted me to act. Kiss time. I froze. Chloe's head snapped in my direction. Oh, my God, how could I have been so stupid? They hadn't bothered to use the duct tape. Rebecca Shays lay upon the table now, whimpering like a dying dog on the side of the road. Sometimes she uttered words, two or even three at a time, but they never formed a coherent chain. She was too far gone to cry anymore. The begging had stopped. Her eyes were still wide and uncomprehending. They saw nothing now. Her mind had shattered mid-scream 15 minutes ago. Amazingly, Wu had left no marks. No marks, but she looked 20 years older. Rebecca Shays had known nothing. Dr. Beck had visited her because of an old car accident that wasn't really a car accident. There were pictures, too. Beck had assumed that she had taken them. She hadn't. The creeping feeling in his stomach, the one that had started as a mere tickle when Larry Gandil first heard about the bodies being found at the lake, kept growing. Something had gone wrong that night. That much was certain. But now Larry Gandil feared that maybe everything had gone wrong. It was time to flush out the truth. He had checked with his surveillance man. Beck was taking his dog for a walk, alone. In light of the evidence Wu would plant, that would be a terrible alibi. The feds would shred it for laughs. Larry Gandil approached the table. Rebecca Shays looked up and made an unearthly noise, a cross between a high-pitched groan and a wounded laugh. He pressed the gun against her forehead. She made that sound again. He fired twice, and all the world fell silent. I started heading back to the house, but I thought about the warning. They're watching. Why take the chance? There was a Kinko's 3 blocks away. They stay open 24 hours a day. When I reached the door, I saw why. It was midnight and the place was packed. Lots of exhausted business people carrying papers and slides and poster boards. I stood in a maze line formed by crushed velvet ropes and waited my turn. It reminded me of visiting a bank in the days before ATMs. The woman in front of me sported a business suit at midnight, and big enough bags under her eyes to be mistaken for a bellhop. Behind me, a man with curly hair and dark sweats whipped out a cell phone and started pressing buttons.
"Sir?"
Someone with a Kinko's smock pointed at Chloe.
"You can't come in here with a dog."
I was about to tell him I already had, but thought better of it. The woman in the business suit didn't react. The curly-haired guy with the dark sweats gave me a what-are-you-gonna-do shrug. I rushed outside, tied Chloe to a parking meter, headed back inside. The curly-haired man let me have my place back in line. Manners. 10 minutes later, I was at the front of the line. This Kinko's clerk was young and overly exuberant. He showed me to a computer terminal and explained too slowly their per-minute pricing plan. I nodded through his little speech and signed on to the web. Kiss time. That, I realized, was the key. The first email had said kiss time, not 6:15 p.m. Why? The answer was obvious. That had been code, in case the wrong people got their hands on the email. Whoever had sent it had realized that the possibility of interception existed. Whoever had sent it had known that only I would know what kiss time meant. That was when it came to me. First off, the account name, Bat Street. When Elizabeth and I were growing up, we used to ride our bikes down Moorwood Street on the way to the Little League field. There was this creepy old woman who lived in a faded yellow house. She lived alone and scowled at passing kids. Every town has one of those creepy old ladies. She usually has a nickname. In our case, we called her Bat Lady. I brought up Bigfoot again. I typed Moorwood into the user name box. Next to me, the young and exuberant Kinko's clerk was repeating his web spiel to the curly-haired man with the dark sweatsuit. I hit the tab button and moved into the text box for the password. The clue, teenage, was easier. In our junior year of high school, we'd gone to Jordan Goldman's house late one Friday night. There were maybe 10 of us. Jordan had found out where his father hid a porn video. None of us had ever seen one before. We all watched, laughing uncomfortably, making the usual snide remarks and feeling deliciously naughty. When we needed a name for our intramural softball team, Jordan suggested we use the movie's stupid title, Teenage Sex Poodles. I typed in sex poodles under the password. I swallowed hard and clicked the sign-in icon. I glanced over at the curly-haired man. He was focused on a Yahoo search. I looked back toward the front desk. The woman in the business suit was frowning at another too-happy-at-midnight Kinko's staff member. I waited for the error message. But that didn't happen this time. A welcome screen rolled into view. On the top it read, "Hi, Moorwood." Underneath that it said, "You have one email in your box." My heart felt like a bird banging against my ribcage. I clicked on the new mail icon and did the leg shake again. No Shauna around to stop it. Through the store window, I could see my tethered Chloe. She spotted me and started barking. I put a finger to my lips and signaled for her to hush up. The email message appeared. Washington Square Park. Meet me at the southeast corner. 5 o'clock tomorrow. You'll be followed. And on the bottom, no matter what, I love you. Hope, that caged bird that just won't die, broke free. I leaned back. Tears flooded my eyes. But for the first time in a long while, I let loose a real smile. Elizabeth, she was still the smartest person I knew. Chapter 20. At 2 a.m., I crawled into bed and rolled onto my back. The ceiling started doing the too-many-drink spins. I grabbed the sides of the bed and hung on. Shauna had earlier asked if I had ever been tempted to cheat after getting married. She'd added that last part, the after-getting-married part, because she already knew about the other incident. Technically, I did cheat on Elizabeth once, though cheating doesn't really fit. Cheating denotes doing harm to another. It didn't harm Elizabeth, I'm sure of that. But during my freshman year of college, I partook in a rather pitiful rite of passage known as the collegiate one-night stand, out of curiosity, I guess. Purely experimental and strictly physical. I didn't like it much. I'll spare you the corny sex without love is meaningless cliché. It's not. But while I think it's fairly easy to have sex with someone you don't particularly know or like, it's hard to stay the night. The attraction, as it were, was strictly hormonal. Once the release took place, I wanted out. Sex is for anyone. The aftermath is for lovers. Pretty nice rationalization, don't you think? If it matters, I suspect Elizabeth probably did something similar. We both agreed that we would try to see being such a vague, all-encompassing term, other people when we first got to college. Any indiscretion could thus be chalked up to yet another commitment test. Whenever the subject was raised, Elizabeth denied that there had ever been anyone else. But then again, so did I. The bed continued to spin as I wondered, what do I do now? For one thing, I wait for 5 o'clock tomorrow. But I couldn't just sit back until then. I'd done enough of that already, thank you very much. The truth was, a truth I didn't like to admit even to myself, I hesitated at the lake because I was scared. I climbed out of the water and paused. That gave whomever a chance to hit me. And I didn't fight back after that first strike. I didn't dive for my assailant. I didn't tackle him or even make a fist. I simply went down. I covered up and surrendered and let the stronger man take away my wife. Not again. I considered approaching my father-in-law again. It hadn't escaped my attention that Hoyt might have been less than forthcoming during my previous visit, but what good would that do? Hoyt was either lying or I don't know what. But the message had been clear, tell no one. The only way I could maybe get him to talk would be by telling him what I saw on that street cam, but I wasn't ready to do that yet. I got out of bed and hopped on the computer. I started surfing again. By morning, I had something of a plan. Gary Lamont, Rebecca Shea's husband, didn't panic right away. His wife often worked late, very late, sometimes spending the night on an old cot in the far right corner of her studio. So when 4 in the morning rolled around and Rebecca still wasn't home, he grew only concerned, not panicked. At least that's what he told himself. Gary called her studio, but the answering machine picked up. Again, that wasn't rare. When Rebecca was working, she hated interruptions. She didn't even keep a phone extension in the dark room. He left a message and settled back into their bed. Sleep came in fits and spurts. Gary contemplated doing something more, but that would only piss off Rebecca. She was a free spirit, and if there was a tension in their otherwise fulfilling relationship, it had to do with his relatively traditional lifestyle, clipping her creative wings, her terms. So he gave her space to unclip her wings or whatever. By 7 in the morning, concern had segued into something closer to genuine fear. Gary's call woke up Arturo Ramirez, Rebecca's gaunt, black-clad assistant.
"I just got in,"
Arturo complained groggily. Gary explained the situation. Arturo, who had fallen asleep in his clothes, didn't bother changing. He ran out the door. Gary promised to meet him at the studio. He hopped on the downtown A. Arturo arrived first and found the studio door ajar. He pushed it open.
"Rebecca?"
No answer. Arturo called her name again. Still no answer. He entered and scanned the studio. She wasn't there. He opened the dark room door. The usual harsh smell of film development acid still dominated, but there was something else. Something faint and below the surface that still had the ability to make his hair stand on end. Something distinctly human. Gary rounded the corner in time to hear the scream. Chapter 21. In the morning, I grabbed a bagel and headed west on Route 80 for 45 minutes. Route 80 in New Jersey is a fairly nondescript strip of pavement. Once you get past Saddlebrook or so, the buildings pretty much vanish and you're faced with identical lines of trees on either side of the road. Only the interstate signs break up the monotony. As I veered off exit 163 at a town called Gardensville, I slowed the car and looked out at the high grass. My heart started thumping. I'd never been here before. I'd purposely avoided this stretch of interstate for the past 8 years. But it was here, less than 100 yards from where I now drove, that they found Elizabeth's body. I checked the directions I'd printed off last night. The Sussex County Coroner's Office was on MapQuest.com, so I knew to the tenth of a kilometer how to get there. The building was a blinds-closed storefront with no sign or window lettering, a plain brick rectangle with no frills. But then again, did you want any at a morgue? I arrived a few minutes before 8:30 and pulled around back. The office was still locked up. Good. A canary-yellow Cadillac Seville pulled into a spot marked Timothy Harper, County Medical Examiner. The man in the car stubbed out a cigarette. It never ceases to amaze me how many M.E.s smoke before he stepped out. Harper was my height, a shade under 6 feet, with olive skin and wispy gray hair. He saw me standing by the door and set his face. People didn't visit morgues first thing in the morning to hear good news. He took his time approaching me.
"Can I help you?" he said.
"Dr. Harper?"
"Yes, that's right.
I'm Dr. David Beck." Doctor, so we were colleagues. "I'd like a moment of your time." He didn't react to the name. He took out a key and unlocked the door.
"Why don't we sit in my office?"
"Thank you." I followed him down a corridor. Harper flicked light switches. The ceiling fluorescents popped on grudgingly and one at a time. The floor was scratched linoleum. The place looked less like a house of death than a faceless DMV office, but maybe that was the point. Our footsteps echoed, mixing with the buzzing from the lights as though keeping the beat. Harper picked up a stack of mail and quicksorted it as we walked. Harper's private office, too, was no frills. There was the same metal desk you might find a teacher using in an elementary school. The chairs were over-varnished wood, strictly functional. Several diplomas spotted one wall. He'd gone to medical school at Columbia, too, I saw, though he graduated almost 20 years before me. No family photographs, no golf trophy, no Lucite announcements, nothing personal. Visitors to this office were not in for pleasant chit-chat. The last thing they needed to see was someone smiling grandkids. Harper folded his hands and put them on the desk.
"What can I do for you, Dr. Beck?"
8 years ago, I began, my wife was brought here. She was the victim of a serial killer known as Kilroy. I'm not particularly good at reading faces. Eye contact has never been my forte. Body language means little to me. But as I watched Harper, I couldn't help but wonder what would make a practiced medical examiner, a man who oft dwelled in the world of the dead, blanch so.
"I remember," he said softly.
"You did the autopsy?"
"Yes. Well, in part."
"In part?"
"Yes. The federal authorities were involved, too. We worked on the case in tandem. Though the FBI doesn't have coroners, so we took the lead."
"Back up a minute," I said. "Tell me what you saw when they first brought the body in." Harper shifted in his seat.
May I ask why you want to know this?
I'm a grieving husband.
It was 8 years ago.
We all grieve in our own way, Doctor.
Yes, I'm sure that's true, but...
But what?
But I'd like to know what you want here.
I decided to take the direct route.
You take pictures of every corpse brought in here, right?
He hesitated, and I saw it. He saw me seeing it and cleared his throat.
Yes, currently we use digital technology, a digital camera, in other words. It allows us to store photographs and various images on a computer. We find it helpful for both diagnosis and cataloging.
I nodded, not caring. He was chattering. When he didn't continue, I said, "Did you take pictures of my wife's autopsy?"
"Yes, of course, but how long ago did you say again?"
8 years.
"We would have taken Polaroids."
"And where would those Polaroids be right now, Doctor?"
"In the file."
I looked at the tall filing cabinet standing in the corner like a sentinel.
"Not in there," he added quickly. "Your wife's case is closed. Her killer was caught and convicted. Plus, it was more than 5 years ago."
"So where would it be?"
"In a storage facility in Layton."
"I'd like to see the photographs if I could." He jotted something down and nodded at the scrap of paper.
"I'll look into it."
"Doctor?" He looked up. "You said you remember my wife."
"Well, yes, I mean somewhat. We don't have many murders here, especially one so high profile."
"Do you remember the condition of her body?"
"Not really. I mean, not details or anything."
"Do you remember who identified her?"
"You didn't?"
"No." Harper scratched his temple.
"Her father, wasn't it?"
"Do you remember how long it took for him to make an identification?"
"How long?"
"Was it immediate? Did it take a few minutes? 5 minutes? 10 minutes?
"I really couldn't say."
"You don't remember if it was immediate or not?"
"I'm sorry, I don't."
"You just said this was a big case."
"Yes."
"Maybe your biggest?"
"We had that pizza delivery thrill kill a few years ago," he said. "But yes, I'd say it was one of the biggest."
"And yet you don't remember if her father had trouble identifying the body?" He didn't like that.
"Dr. Beck, with all due respect, I don't see what you're getting at."
"I'm a grieving husband. I'm asking some simple questions."
"Your tone," he said. "It seems hostile."
"Should it be?"
"What on earth does that mean?"
"How did you know she was a victim of Kilroy's?"
"I didn't."
"So how did the feds get involved?"
"There were identifying marks."
"You mean that she was branded with the letter K?"
"Yes."
I was on a roll now, and it felt oddly right. "So the police brought her in. You started examining her. You spotted the letter K?"
"No, they were here right away, the federal authorities, I mean."
"Before the body got here?"
He looked up, either remembering or fabricating. "Or immediately thereafter, I don't remember."
"How did they know about the body so quickly?"
"I don't know."
"You have no idea?"
Harper folded his arms across his chest. "I might surmise that one of the officers on the scene spotted the branding and called the FBI, but that would only be an educated guess."
My beeper vibrated against my hip. I checked it. The clinic with an emergency.
"I'm sorry for your loss," he said in a practiced tone. "I understand the pain you must be going through, but I have a very busy schedule today. Perhaps you can make an appointment at a later date?"
"How long will it take you to get my wife's file?" I asked.
"I'm not even sure I can do that. I mean, I'll have to check."
"The Freedom of Information Act."
"Pardon me?"
"I looked it up this morning. My wife's case is closed now. I have the right to view her file." Harper had to know that. I wasn't the first person to ask for an autopsy file. And he started nodding a little too vigorously.
Still, there are proper channels you have to go through, forms to fill out.
Are you stalling? I said.
Excuse me?
My wife was the victim of a terrible crime.
I understand that.
And I have the right to view my wife's file. If you drag your feet on this, I'm going to wonder why. I've never spoken to the media about my wife or her killer. I'll gladly do so now, and we'll all be wondering why the local M.E. gave me such a hard time over such a simple request.
That sounds like a threat, Dr. Beck.
I got to my feet.
I'll be back here tomorrow morning, I said. Please have my wife's file ready.
I was taking action. It felt damn good.
Chapter 22. Detectives Roland DeMonte and Kevin Krinsky of the NYPD's Homicide Division arrived first on the scene, even before the uniforms. DeMonte, a greasy-haired man who favored hideous snakeskin boots and an overchewed toothpick, took the lead. He barked orders. The crime scene was immediately sealed. A few minutes later, lab technicians from the crime scene units skulked in and spread out.
"Isolate the witnesses," DeMonte said.
There were only two, the husband and the fey weirdo in black. DeMonte noted that the husband appeared distraught, though that could be an act. But first things first. DeMonte, still chewing on the toothpick, took the fey weirdo, his name, figures, was Arturo, to the side. The kid looked pale. Normally, DeMonte would guess drugs, but the guy had tossed his cookies when he found the body.
"You okay?"
DeMonte asked, like he cared. Arturo nodded.
DeMonte asked him if anything unusual had happened involving the victim lately.
"Yes," Arturo replied. "What would that be?"
"Rebecca got a phone call yesterday that disturbed her. Who called?"
Arturo wasn't sure. But an hour later, maybe less, Arturo couldn't be sure, a man stopped by to see Rebecca. When the man left, Rebecca was a wreck.
"Do you remember the man's name?"
"Beck," Arturo said. "She called the guy Beck."
Shauna put Mark's sheets in the dryer. Linda came up behind her.
"He's wetting his bed again," Linda said.
"God, you're perceptive."
"Don't be mean." Linda walked away. Shauna opened her mouth to apologize, but nothing came out. When she had moved out the first time, the only time, Mark had reacted badly. It started with bedwetting. When she and Linda reunited, the bedwetting stopped. Until now.
"He knows what's going on," Linda said. "He can feel the tension."
"What do you want me to do about that, Linda?"
"Whatever we have to."
"I'm not moving out again, I promised."
"Clearly that's not enough."
Shauna tossed a sheet of fabric softener into the dryer. Exhaustion lined her face. She didn't need this. She was a big money model. She couldn't arrive at work with bags under her eyes or a lack of sheen in her hair. She didn't need this shit. She was tired of it all. Tired of a domesticity that didn't sit well with her. Tired of the pressure from damn do-gooders. Forget the bigotry, that was easy. But the pressure on a lesbian couple with a child, applied by supposedly well-meaning supporters, was beyond suffocating. If the relationship failed, it was a failure for all lesbianism or some such crap, as though hetero couples never break up. Shauna wasn't a crusader, she knew that. Selfish or not, her happiness wouldn't be sacrificed on the altar of greater good. She wondered if Linda felt the same way.
"I love you," Linda said.
"I love you too."
They looked at each other. Mark was wetting his bed again. Shauna wouldn't sacrifice herself for the greater good, but she would for Mark.
"So what do we do?" Linda asked.
We work it out. You think we can? You love me?
You know I do, Linda said.
Do you still think I'm the most exciting, wonderful creature on God's green earth?
Oh, yeah, Linda said.
Me too. Shauna smiled at her. I'm a narcissistic pain in the ass.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm your narcissistic pain in the ass.
Damn straight.
Shauna moved closer. I'm not destined for a life of easy relationships. I'm volatile.
You're sexy as hell when you're volatile, Linda said.
And even when I'm not.
Shut up and kiss me.
The downstairs door buzzer sounded. Linda looked at Shauna. Shauna shrugged. Linda pressed the intercom and said,
Yes? Is this Linda Beck?
Who is this?
I'm Special Agent Kimberly Green with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I'm with my partner, Special Agent Rick Peck. We'd like to come up and ask you some questions.
Shauna leaned over before Linda could respond.
Our attorney's name is Hester Krimstein, she shouted into the intercom. You can call her.
You're not suspects in any crime. We just want to ask you some questions.
Hester Krimstein, Shauna interrupted. I'm sure you have her number. Have a really special day.
Shauna released the button. Linda looked at her.
What the hell was that?
Your brother's in trouble.
What?
Sit down, Shauna said. We need to talk.